Welcome to this audio issue of Distressed Investing, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on September 11, 2025. Investing with a Titan. Icahn's portfolio could decline 39% and still cover its debt. For 50 years, this brash investor has scored hefty returns. Some time ago, this company's stock got battered, sliced, and diced. But currently, despite that shock, its bonds are underpriced. Martin Fridson. Carl Icahn never liked being told no. By the early 1980s, the now legendary investor had already built a reputation as a ruthless corporate raider, someone who went into struggling companies, shook up their boards, and walked away with profit. To him, corporations were like chessboards. The CEOs thought they were kings, but Icahn preferred to remind them that queens and rooks, shareholders and capital, moved with far more power. Hammermill Paper, a venerable but complacent Pennsylvania paper company, caught Icahn's attention in 1981. He quietly accumulated a stake and then made his intentions clear. He wanted seats on the board and changes to strategy. Management bristled. To them, Icahn wasn't a savior, he was a raider threatening decades of tradition. They accused him publicly of playing a get-rich-quick scheme. Icahn, unfazed, launched a proxy fight to win control of the board. He mailed letters, lobbied shareholders, and spent more than $1 million rallying support. For weeks, both sides crisscrossed the country, pitching their visions. Hammermill's executives stressed stability and community. Icahn promised higher returns and leaner operations. Shareholders were split. The annual meeting that year was tense, with lawyers and accountants hunched over tabulations. When preliminary counts were announced, Icahn appeared to have won one of the two contested board seats. For Icahn, it was vindication. His hard-charging style had pierced the paper company's defenses. But then came the audit. A suspicious block of 70,000 shares tipped the scales in Icahn's favor. Hammermill's team pushed back, demanding a recount. The truth soon emerged. Icahn's proxies included shares borrowed at the last minute from Citibank. Because they weren't properly registered in time, they were ineligible to vote. Suddenly, Icahn's apparent victory vanished. The boardroom door slammed shut. The fallout was dramatic. Icahn's opponents called it a humiliation, proof that his methods were reckless. Hammermill executives, relieved, portrayed themselves as defenders of tradition who had fended off an opportunist. The press painted Icahn as brash and overextended, a Wall Street gambler who overplayed his hand. But Icahn himself refused to see it that way. Emerging from the setback, he told reporters, "We may have lost the battle, but I don't feel we lost the war." The line captured his essence, defiant, unbowed, and ready for the next fight. Indeed, while Hammermill survived Icahn's raid, the broader corporate world had been put on notice. Icahn's proxy contest demonstrated how vulnerable even well-established companies were to aggressive outsiders. CEOs around the country began scrambling for poison pill defenses, while investors increasingly watched Icahn's next move. For Icahn, the Hammermill episode wasn't an embarrassing failure but a lesson. Battles were messy, outcomes uncertain, but persistence was everything. If one door closed, another company would open. And in time, Icahn's relentless campaigns against giants like Trans World Airlines, Time Warner, and Texaco would cement his reputation as the most feared activist investor of his generation. Hammermill Paper might have won the day, but Carl Icahn walked away with something more enduring: the knowledge that even in defeat, the mere threat of his presence could shake boardrooms to their core. Still as brash as ever. In today's report, we present an opportunity to profit alongside Icahn, the sage investor now with 45 more years of success since that run-in with Hammermill. We're recommending a bond that's secured by Icahn's portfolio, which is worth 60% more than all his company's debt combined. The bonds yield 9.7% and mature in just under 3.5 years. In our February 2025 report, A New Burst of Life, we detailed Icahn's bitter public fight with Pershing Square Capital's Bill Ackman over Herbalife, NYSE, HLF. Ackman bet the stock would plummet. Icahn bought it aggressively. After the literal shouting was done, Ackman lost more than $1 billion and Icahn cleared an estimated $1.3 billion. For roughly 50 years, Icahn has scored hefty returns, bringing his net worth at one point to more than $20 billion. His reputation and net worth took a big hit in 2023 when a short seller's report argued the shares of Icahn Enterprises Partners, LP, his public investment vehicle and the issuer of the bonds we are recommending this month, were overvalued. This broadside shook investor confidence in everything bearing the Icahn name. If not for this negative report on IEP in 2023, which we'll discuss in detail, we believe Icahn Enterprises' 9.75% bonds maturing January 15, 2029, would not offer such a high annual yield of 9.7% in today's market. This month's recommendation reminds us of our very first distressed investing recommendation in March 2023, when we wrote about diversified healthcare trusts, NASDAQ, DHC 9.75% bonds. In that case, like this Icahn Enterprises investment, the bonds were secured by assets that comfortably exceeded the company's total debt. The diversified healthcare bonds were priced at $972, with an annual return of roughly 10%. Today's bonds are priced at $1,000, with an annual return of close to 10%. We believe that in both cases, investors were looking backward rather than forward, creating an opportunity for high, risk-adjusted returns. Who is Carl Icahn? Carl Icahn studied philosophy at Princeton University and played chess in his spare time. After graduating in 1957, he enrolled in medical school at New York University, dropped out 2 years later, and joined the Army. In 1961, he became a stockbroker at Dreyfus Corporation, where he became known as a skilled options trader. He is pictured here with his son Brett. This trading success led Icahn's uncle to purchase a seat on the New York Stock Exchange for him in 1967. The next year, at age 32, Icahn opened his own brokerage business, Icahn & Company. That business specialized in options trading and merger arbitrage, investing in announced, but uncompleted, corporate combinations. The skill here in that game is being able to predict if a proposed merger will receive the government and shareholder approvals it will need to be completed. If a merger goes through, the stock rises. If the deal falls apart, the stock often plummets. As an accomplished chess player, Icahn could think many moves ahead. Merger arbitrage played into this strength. His business flourished, leading him to want to purchase a company on his own. In 1979, he fought for and won a seat on the board of Tappan Company, a maker of kitchen appliances. He used his foothold to call for the company to be sold, lobbying other shareholders and threatening to replace Tappan's management. Shortly afterward, the company was sold to appliance maker Electrolux and Icahn notched a $3 million profit. Icahn, the activist investor. This was the start of Icahn's career as an activist investor, a corporate outsider who buys up a large chunk of a company's stock and pushes for changes intended to increase the stock price. Activist investors typically line up support from other large investors like themselves. The proposals usually feature some combination of cutting costs, changing management, buying back shares, selling business lines, or putting the entire company up for sale. As we mentioned, he tried to gain control of the board of Hammermill Paper in 1981 and was unsuccessful. But he regrouped, and in 1982 Icahn headed a number of investors who bought a 17% stake in Marshall Field & Company, the venerable Chicago-based chain of department stores founded in 1852. The company's management fought back. They sued to block Icahn's group from acquiring additional stock. They branded Icahn a notorious corporate opportunist. Icahn may have been called names, but he scored a big but undisclosed payday when Marshall Field was sold later that year to British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI. Success followed success. Before long, Icahn took on Phillips Petroleum, PSX, then a top-tier oil company, which led to an even bigger payoff. He stooped as low as the law permitted. One of the sleaziest plays in the activist investor's bag of tricks is known as greenmail. The maneuver involves first buying a large block of a company's stock and threatening to agitate for a management change, expecting management will prefer to pay the potential agitator to go away. Typically, this means the company buying back the activist shares at a price significantly above market. In other words, management would use the other shareholders' money to pay off the greenmailer at a price higher than where other shareholders could sell their own shares. Although frowned upon, the practice is legal. Management will argue, sincerely or not, that in the long run the shares will be worth more than the greenmailer received. Icahn became known for his take-no-prisoners ruthlessness. He was happy to win short-term profits at the expense of the long-term viability of a business. He would advocate selling off a company's most valuable pieces. This would generate cash, which would be used to buy back shares, sometimes only Icahn's shares. The example of asset stripping most often cited is Trans World Airlines, TWA, the company controlled by Howard Hughes that was once among the world's most successful airlines. The saga of TWA. In 1985, Icahn acquired more than 20% of the stock of TWA, which was struggling to stay profitable after the 1978 airline deregulation. 3 years after buying the stock, Icahn led a buyout of TWA. Icahn planned to fund his takeover by borrowing against TWA's assets, its planes, routes, and gates. While the shareholders profited from the transaction, including Icahn, who recorded a $469 million gain selling his shares to himself. The airline was left heavily in debt. After he bought the company, Icahn negotiated stiff pay cuts for pilots and cut back on orders for aircraft that would have modernized TWA's fleet. In 1991, he sold TWA's crown jewel, its New York-London routes, to American Airlines, AAL, for $445 million. Many then considered it to be a fire sale price, made necessary by the need to service TWA's high level of debt. In 1992, TWA filed for bankruptcy and emerged reorganized in 1993. Its debt load was reduced from before the bankruptcy, but the company still owed $190 million on a loan from Icahn himself, who by then had resigned as company chair. The company didn't have, and couldn't borrow, enough to repay that debt when it came due in 1995. TWA filed for bankruptcy for the second time in 3 years. Icahn's debt was secured by most of TWA's assets. He could have forced the sale of those assets, which would have put TWA out of business permanently. Instead, Icahn agreed to let TWA come out of bankruptcy and continue to operate. His price was steep. He essentially forced TWA to sign what became known as the Korabu Ticket Agreement. Korabu was the entity Icahn used to make the deal. The Korabu Agreement gave Icahn the right to buy an unlimited number of tickets on any TWA flight going through its hub in St. Louis at a 45% discount from the regular fare. For example, he could buy a $200 ticket for $110. The internet was in its infancy in 1995, and its usage was beginning to take off. Icahn latched onto the trend and created a website named lowestfare.com, where he offered the TWA tickets at discounts from TWA's normal ticket prices. This meant that on many flights, Icahn was undercutting TWA's fares and making a bundle. It's generally believed that this agreement cost TWA roughly $100 million per year. Against all odds, TWA made a profit in the quarter that ended June 30, 1996. It even survived the explosion on July 17, 1996, of Flight 800 from New York to Paris, when all 230 passengers and the crew were killed. But the loss of its New York to London routes, combined with unions looking to make up ground after the lean Icahn years, became too much to overcome. In January 2001, TWA filed its third and final bankruptcy, and never re-emerged. Its assets were sold to American Airlines. Our main takeaway from the TWA story is that it's better to be on Carl Icahn's side than to sit across the table from him. Icahn Enterprise Partners. While the TWA saga played out, Carl Icahn had a finger in many other pies. Among them, in 1990 he gained control of American Real Estate Partners, AREP, which owned office buildings and warehouses and other commercial properties across the U.S. Double taxation is a key part of this story. A corporation pays tax on its income. And if the corporation pays a dividend, the shareholder also pays income tax on any money received in dividends paid. AREP was structured as a master limited partnership. MLPs have a tax advantage over traditional corporations because their earnings are only taxed once. The business pays no tax. All its income is allocated to its partners, who pay income tax on the entire amount. In this example, we look at how a dollar of earnings is taxed in both cases. We assume a corporate tax rate of 30% and an individual rate of 40%. In this example, the partnership saves 18 cents on each dollar earned. But there's a catch. The owner of an MLP unit must pay the tax on his share of the business's earnings, regardless of whether it's paid or retained. For this reason, the MLP structure is best suited to businesses that generate steady cash and don't need significant capital expenditures, like real estate or oil production. Technically, individuals own partnership interests in an MLP, and they own shares of a corporation. This distinction does not matter to Icahn Enterprises bondholders, who get paid before any cash is distributed. In this report, we'll use partnership interest and shares interchangeably. Carl Icahn gives AREP the business. In 2007, Carl Icahn sold his investment management business to AREP in exchange for additional, newly issued shares of AREP stock. He changed the name of the business to Icahn Enterprises, LP, NASDAQ, IEP. After the transaction, Icahn owned, and still owns, roughly 85% of the partnership units. Icahn derived various benefits from the combination. He could raise capital from the public by selling new partnership units, rounding out his investor base, until then limited to wealthy individuals and large institutional investors. He could buy or sell IEP shares conveniently. As a public business with a professional management team, the business would continue after his death. Carl Icahn's investments. Since 2007, Carl Icahn has invested through Icahn Enterprises as well as his privately owned hedge funds. Most of his total profits have come from activist investments. A few of Icahn's many highest profile targets have been Apple, AAPL, He urged stock buyback program and earned a profit estimated at $1.8 billion. Netflix, NFLX, he saw the company as undervalued, agitated for change, and he earned $1.9 billion on $321 million investment. Herbalife, HLF, he urged accelerated stock buyback and made a profit estimated at $1.3 billion. He also earned well over $1 billion buying and selling casinos in Las Vegas. Icahn has made money on a high percentage of his activist investments over a long period of time. Icahn Enterprises' current portfolio. Icahn structured the Icahn Enterprises portfolio to avoid becoming an investment company, which would be taxed more heavily than a partnership. To remain taxed as a partnership, a company can have no more than 40% of its assets in investment securities, which are basically traded stocks. The Investment Company Act excludes majority-owned businesses and investments in private partnerships from the category. For this reason, as of June 30, Icahn Enterprises' $7.9 billion portfolio is made up of $4.4 billion of majority-owned businesses, $2.4 billion of investments in private Icahn-managed partnerships, and $1.1 billion in cash. Investment segments. Icahn Enterprises' largest investment is $2.4 billion allocated to private Icahn-managed funds open only to the firm and the Icahn family. These funds are allowed to be invested in a wide variety of assets and typically hedge their investments to limit exposure to major market declines. Including cash, Icahn Enterprises has $3.5 billion invested in these private funds. As of June 30, five investments in large, easily traded stocks accounted for roughly 80% of the fund's assets. Energy. Icahn Enterprises' largest directly owned investment, $1.9 billion, is a 70% stake in CVR Energy, a petroleum refiner. The company also produces and markets renewable fuels like biodiesel. It also manufactures nitrogen fertilizer through its 37% owned subsidiary CVR Partners LP. Automotive. Icahn Automotive Group, IAG, owns businesses that repair or maintain automobiles, most notably Pep Boys, Amco Transmissions, and Precision Tune Auto Care. The company also has a large portfolio of real estate assets, owned property and leases, that account for approximately 60% of IAG's assets. As of June 30, Icahn Enterprises valued this business at $1.2 billion, based on a variety of appraisals, with $752 million of the total attributable to real estate. Real estate. Separately, Icahn Enterprises also owns a real estate business focused on developing luxury single-family homes surrounding country clubs. In June, the company recognized a $47 million gain on the sale of a country club. It intends to reinvest the proceeds in a recently acquired club in Pinehurst, North Carolina. As of June 30, the company was valued at $715 million, based on outside appraisals. Home fashion. In 2005, Carl Icahn acquired West Point Stevens, which makes sheets and towels for the storied brands of West Point Pepperell and J.P. Stevens. The business now focuses on the hotel business worldwide. Icahn Enterprises valued this business at $197 million as of June 30, based on appraisals, pharmaceuticals. Icahn Enterprises owns Vivus LLC, a pharmaceutical company that develops and markets drugs that treat serious conditions such as obesity and exocrine pancreatic inefficiency. Vivus is also developing drugs to treat pulmonary arterial hypertension, a variety of high blood pressure, and to prepare patients for bone marrow transplants. As of June 30, Icahn Enterprises valued the company at $197 million, based on appraisals. Food packaging. The company owns 91% of Viscase Companies, which manufactures casings for processed foods such as hot dogs and bologna. The remaining 9% of Viscase's shares are publicly owned but inactively traded. The company values this position at $71 million, based on a financial model. Hindenburg recommends shorting Icahn. Hindenburg Research, named for the famous Zeppelin Hindenburg that famously exploded in 1937, is dedicated to identifying stocks it believes are extremely overvalued and should be sold short. In short selling, the investor borrows shares that he sells, hoping to buy them back at a lower price. The research firm focuses on how companies value their assets and how the markets value these businesses. On May 1, 2023, the day before Hindenburg released a report on Icahn Enterprises, shares of IEP closed at $50.42. In its report, Hindenburg argued that IEP shares were overvalued and should be sold short, based on three main points. Carl Icahn didn't disclose that he had pledged his own shares as collateral for loans unrelated to Icahn Enterprises. Since he owned more than 85% of the company's shares, if a bank foreclosed on the collateral and sold the shares, their price would almost certainly decline substantially. Icahn Enterprises was overvaluing its real estate holdings and its stocks where there was no active market to verify the balance sheet value. Icahn Enterprises shares were trading at 218% of net asset value, NAV. In other words, the market was paying an excessively large premium to invest alongside Carl Icahn. The report showed that comparable funds, run by big investors like Bill Ackman and Dan Loeb, were trading at less than the value of their holdings. In response to the first point, Carl Icahn amended his disclosure on pledging IEP shares as collateral for his loans. As to Hindenburg's second point, Icahn Enterprises uses outside appraisers to value most of its illiquid assets. The risk relating to how Icahn values his assets remains, as it does for investors of any investment manager with substantial assets that don't have a publicly traded market to establish value. The third point is not a matter of direct concern for Icahn Enterprises bondholders, who care about the value of Icahn Enterprises' assets rather than its stock price. For the record, IEP's share price plummeted on the news of the Hindenburg report from $50.42 on May 1 to $22.38 at the end of the month. Since then, the price has continued to fall to a current price of $8.29, which still represents a 46% premium over net asset value of $5.67. Icahn's dividend history. The NAV of a share of IEP changes from quarter to quarter based on the valuation of its assets. NAV is reduced by the amount of cash distributed to shareholders. Icahn Enterprises' quarterly distributions have been large. For example, a shareholder choosing to receive cash each quarter would have received $6.50 in distributions since the date of the Hindenburg report. For a bondholder, every dollar paid out to shareholders is not available to make debt payments. If the appreciation in Icahn Enterprises' portfolio during a given quarter exceeds its distribution to shareholders, the value of Icahn Enterprises' portfolio of assets increases, as does lender's safety cushion. In periods in which quarterly distributions exceed the return on Icahn's portfolio, that margin gets smaller. As an analogy, if your stock portfolio goes up 3% in a quarter and you withdraw 2%, the value of your portfolio rises 1%. If you change your distribution to 4%, it declines 1%. Since the beginning of 2023, Icahn Enterprises' portfolio rose $3.62 per share and the company distributed $10.50 per share. This means the value of Icahn Enterprises' portfolio and the bondholders' collateral has declined $6.88 per share, $3.62 minus $10.50. Portfolio value covers debt by at least 163%. After accounting for these distributions, recall that Icahn Enterprises had $7.9 billion in assets as of June 30. At the same time, Icahn Enterprises also had total debt outstanding of $4.86 billion. We can calculate the bondholder's safety cushion in two ways, depending on how we account for the $1.1 billion in cash. If we view cash as a portfolio investment, and it might be invested at any time, Icahn Enterprises' assets equate to 163% of its liabilities. If we base our calculations on Icahn Enterprises' net debt, a standard practice among investors, Icahn Enterprises' assets, excluding cash, equate to 181% of net debt. For this discussion, we will take the more conservative route and treat cash as a portfolio asset. Using this approach, Icahn Enterprises' portfolio could decline 39% and still cover all of its debt. Total assets $7.92 billion. Total debt $4.86 billion. Safety cushion $3.05 billion. Safety cushion $3.05 billion. Total assets $7.92 billion. Cushion as percentage of total assets 39%. In practice, the safety margin is much larger as a percentage of Icahn Enterprises' assets that have market risk. The $2.5 billion investment in Icahn's other funds is hedged, with short sales, put options, and more, to protect against sharp market declines. There is $1.1 billion in risk-free cash. This leaves $4.3 billion of assets exposed to market risk and a $3.05 billion cushion. Using this approach, the risk assets could fall 71%, $3.05 billion divided by $4.3 billion, and total assets would cover all of Icahn Enterprises' debt. Icahn's ownership stake. Say what you will about Carl Icahn, and over the years many people have said many bad things about him, the man eats his own cooking. Through thick and thin, Carl Icahn has added to his shareholdings, largely by taking most quarterly distributions in shares rather than in cash. He has kept his ownership in Icahn Enterprises steady at between 85% and 90%. These shares have value only as long as bondholders get paid on time and in full. Recent share buybacks. From time to time, Icahn Enterprises has repurchased its own shares or bonds in the open market. Over the last year, the company bought back $269 million of its bonds, usually at a discount to their $1,000 face value. Its board of directors has authorized the company to repurchase up to $500 million more Icahn Enterprises bonds and up to $500 million in IEP shares. We would expect management to consider any meaningful decline in bond prices to be an opportunity to buy back bonds cheaply. Management has indicated that it wants to increase its dry powder available to take advantage of market declines, so we don't envision the company buying back stock anytime soon. In November 2024, it reduced quarterly distributions to 50 cents per quarter and indicated they may be reduced further. On August 26, 2025, Icahn Enterprises took a further step to bolster its capital, which is good for bondholders, by indicating it would look to raise up to $412.6 million from the sale of new shares. Discussion of bond terms. Icahn Enterprises 9.75% bonds mature January 15, 2029. This $700 million issue, along with the rest of its roughly $4.9 billion in debt, is secured by substantially all the partnership's assets. The indenture for the 9.75% bonds limits how much Icahn Enterprises can borrow against the company's assets. The company is not permitted to borrow additional funds if its total debt exceeds 1.15x the company's net worth. Based on the company's balance sheet as of June 30, Icahn Enterprises is not permitted to borrow additional funds, although it's permitted to refinance its existing bonds as they mature. Total debt $4.9 billion divided by net worth $3.4 billion equals debt slash net worth 1.42x exceeds 1.15x. Icahn Enterprises' assets would need to rise by over $1 billion before it would be able to borrow any additional funds. The bond indenture limits the amount IEP can distribute to shareholders to 50% of profits from April 1, 2014, plus the value of all additional shares sold or paid to shareholders in lieu of cash minus the total of dividends paid since April 2014. Icahn Enterprises doesn't provide the information needed to update this calculation. The upper limit on distributions was last reported as of March 31, 2021, as $500 million plus the value of any new shares. This number would likely be lower now. The company is specifically permitted to make distributions of up to $1 per share each year. Bondholders are indifferent as to how many new shares the company issues in order to fund cash distributions. Bondholders care about the value of Icahn Enterprises' assets and the total of its debt. Beginning August 1, 2028, Icahn Enterprises can call these bonds at $1,000 plus accrued interest. Before then, the company can redeem these bonds at $1,000 plus a premium that depends on interest rates at that time. Given the high coupon on these bonds, this premium might conceivably be something like $50 to $100 per bond. This said, we don't expect Icahn Enterprises to redeem the bonds before August 1, 2028. Risks. While we're comfortable that IEP's portfolio covers all its debt with a comfortable margin for error, an investment in these bonds involves risk, most significantly. A considerable percentage of Icahn Enterprises' holdings are in other Icahn-related funds that don't disclose their investments. The company provides only very broad descriptions of these holdings. There's no verifiable market value for some of Icahn Enterprises' direct holdings such as Icahn Automotive Group, Vivus, and West Point Pepperell. Bondholders rely on the company to value these assets based on models and third-party appraisals. Carl Icahn is 90 years old. Brett Icahn, his son, is slated to succeed him no later than in 2027. The younger Icahn's talent as portfolio manager is unknown. Even though IEP hedges much of its portfolio, it's possible, but unlikely, that the value of IEP's assets could fall below the amount of IEP's debt during a severe market downturn. All of IEP's investments have their own associated risks. For CVR Energy, those would include refining margins, environmental regulations, and demand for petroleum-based and renewable fuels. Carl Icahn has pledged a large percentage of his IEP shares as collateral for loans unrelated to the company. In the unlikely event that he defaults on his loan, the value of Icahn Enterprises' assets would not change. The resulting turmoil might cause the price of the 9.75% bonds to decline over the near term. Recommendation. We recommend purchasing Icahn Enterprises' 9.75% bonds maturing January 15, 2029, up to a price of $1,020, which would equate to an annual yield of roughly 9.0%. Action to take. Buy Icahn Enterprises, NASDAQ, IEP 9.75% bonds maturing January 15, 2029, CUSIP hashtag 45102CF2, up to $1,020. Martin Fridson, Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Distressed Investing. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, You should check out our best buys where we highlight current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the best buys under the best buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.